We're going to be continuing our series in the book of Song of Songs this morning. So please do turn to page 681 in the church Bibles. That's page 681, and we'll be reading from chapter 2, verse 7, to chapter 5, verse 1. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Listen, my beloved, look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. My beloved spoke and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. See, the winter is past, the rains are over and gone. Flowers appear on the earth. The season of singing has come. The cooing of doves is heard in our land. The fig tree forms its early fruit. The blossoming vines spread their fragrance. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me.
My dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the hiding places on the mountainside, show me your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom.
My beloved is mine and I am his. He browses among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the rugged hills. All night long on my bed, I looked for the one my heart loves. I looked for him, but did not find him. I will get up now and go about the city, through its streets and squares. I will search for the one my heart loves. So I looked for him, but did not find him. The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. Have you seen the one my heart loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found the one my heart loves. I held him and would not let him go till I had brought him to my mother's house, to the room of the one who conceived me. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Who is this coming up from the wilderness like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it is Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon. Its posts he made of silver, its base of gold. Its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior inlaid with love. Daughters of Jerusalem, come out and look, you daughters of Zion. Look on King Solomon wearing a crown, the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced.
How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from the hills of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn, coming up from the washing. It has its twin, not one of them is alone. Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon, your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with courses of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. You are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Amana, from the top of Senir, the summit of Hermon, from the lion's dens and the mountain haunts of leopards. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume more than any spice? Your lips drop sweetness as a honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates, with choice fruits, with henna and nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes, and all the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water, streaming down from Lebanon.
Awake, north wind, and come, south wind. Blow on my garden, that its fragrance may spread everywhere. Let my beloved come into his garden and taste its choice fruits.
I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk.
Eat, friends, and drink. Drink your fill of love. This is the word of the Lord. Yes, it's worth reminding ourselves of that when you read something of that ilk. You think, oh, right, that's in the Bible, is it? Okay. And it is. If you've not met, my name's Matt Fulham, the vicar here. It'd be lovely to meet you afterwards. And if you come and that's the reading and this is the sermon and this is your first time, okay. It is an unusual part of the scriptures, I think. And for the rest of us, it's interesting, the Song of Songs. And it's painful, and it's actually quite hard to understand sometimes, so we need God's help. Let me pray as we look at this together. Our great God and Father, thank you that in your tender kindness you give us all that we need. You deliver to us, you speak to us the words that we need, and we need these words. We do pray you'd give us understanding, help us understand them rightly. We find it hard at points getting our heads around poetry. But Father, help us to comprehend what you're saying at every level. And Father, help us respond rightly, to trust you, to love you. There are painful things here, awkward things here, but you are a very tender God who delights and indeed sings for joy over his people. Help us see you rightly. Through this scripture, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Now, a number of years ago, as a family, we had a few days' holiday in Marrakesh, and some would have been there. And it's a very stimulating place. It's a city of hustle and bustle, perhaps at points a little overstimulating, and you're desperate to get away from it. All the streets are crowded and dusty and a little bit smelly at points. It's a sensory overload, a little bit intense, the old city of Marrakesh. But on our last day there, we found this glorious place, the Secret Garden, and the clue's in the name. It's a garden, and you have to work quite hard to find it, because they discovered that centuries ago, some very affluent family had laid out and built this garden, I don't know, four times the size of this church building, which in a city such as Marrakesh, where space is at a premium, extraordinary, but it's hidden. You know, you wouldn't know it's there. You go through a tiny little gate, and there all of a sudden this garden, vast, opens up, and they've sort of discovered it and relayed it out and grown all sorts of plants there, and it is beautiful. And a real oasis in the madness of the city. But to have seen it centuries ago, just enormous privilege to go into a garden such as that. I mean, in the 10th century BC, when Solomon is writing, and gardens were of a similar sort of ilk, locked away, only the wealthy would have them. Flowers, you go grow flowers, they're of no use to you in Palestine. So a real sense of privilege, affluence, wealth to be in a garden such as that, or such as this in the Song of Songs. Because this idea of a garden with fertile plants and an abundance of flowers all in bloom is in many senses the dominant metaphor for a sexual relationship within marriage within the book of the Song of Songs. And so we had it strongly in our reading today. So chapter 4, verse 12, for example, before their wedding day, the groom can describe the bride as, "You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You're a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. I can look through and see what the garden is like, but you're not mine yet. I'm not allowed to go there." But they're married. And chapter 4, verse 16, she can say, "Let my beloved come into his garden." And chapter 5, verse 1, "I've come into my garden, my sister, my bride." The metaphor throughout here is that marriage is meant to be a garden of sexual delight in the Song of Songs. And we might think of that and laugh or cry or smile for all number of reasons. But that is how it's meant to be. That sex is a gift from the Lord, and it's a great blessing. It is an intense symbol of self-giving within marriage. It's those wonderful lines in the marriage service, that marriage is given as a gift of God in part, that man and wife should enjoy and come together in the delight and tenderness of sexual union as they commit their whole lives together. That's what it's meant to be. And of course, in some ways, just sexual activity, you could take it as a symbol for all that's gone wrong in our world. As sex is abused, it's cheapened, it's bought and sold commercially. It's used even within marriages as a power play. Dominance can be exerted. Stressed in some relationships, abused, withheld. So it's both a wonderful, wonderful blessing, and yet, can cause great harm as well. And that's how we're going to look at it this morning. Two points we'll look at: protecting the garden and enjoying the garden. And there's a time for both. Now, if you were away last week, just to bring you up to speed, I read the Song of Songs as a poem. It's one song written anonymously, primarily by, it's presented as written by a young woman, chiefly. And it's two things, really. On the first hand, on the surface level, it is describing love and desire within a human marriage. And so it's overwhelmingly written by a woman, and she describes her lover, her groom, as her Solomon. He's my beloved, or so the one I love, he's like a king. He's like my Romeo, my Adonis, whatever pet name you choose to use in your household. So she ascribes him to be like a king. And so in that sense, the song, it stresses the beauty of sex within marriage, and comments upon its frustrations and awkwardness and pain as well. But the book is here, in one sense, to remind us that sexual relationship within marriage is a good gift from God. And that's, in one sense, the primary level it's written. But secondarily, you can't avoid the fact that the language that is used here, it is intending us to read this, to see this as a picture of Christ and his church. Even in our passage today, you get some of these language that the groom is like a pillar of smoke in the wilderness. It's very much like Exodus, isn't it? Where the Lord leads his people like a pillar of smoke through the wilderness. She is like a vineyard, and he is the owner of the vineyard. That's very much like the book of Isaiah, particularly Isaiah 5. God says, "Israel is my vineyard." The woman here is described in language. We'll get to the weird language. But she's described like the promised land, I think. Her longings for her king, for her groom. Particularly when she's on her bed longing, chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. It's almost identical in some senses to Psalm 63, where David says, as we sung, "As the deer pants for the water, so I long for you, my Lord." The linguistic overlap is extraordinary, actually. So we're meant to go, well, this is a relationship about a man and a woman, obviously, yes. But it's a bit weird how biblical the language is and how recurrent the language is for the Lord and his people. Which is it? It's both. We're meant to learn about both. But this morning I want to concentrate really on this metaphor that crops up numerous times here of the garden. Because in its recurrent imagery of fertile gardens and plants in bloom and vineyards bursting with fruit, the song is looking back to the Garden of Eden, before sin had touched this world, before human relationships were broken, distorted, and says that was wonderful. A world of perfect relationships where the man and woman were naked and felt no shame. It all was good. It looks back to that. And it is looking forward to a new Eden, a new creation, where again, human relationships and those between men and women will be perfect, and there is no awkwardness and there is no shame. And the centerpiece of that garden is the Lord Jesus Christ as the bridegroom to his people. It looks to that in the garden. So we're Londoners and we know very little about gardening, but let's have a go this morning. Two things then we look at. Protecting the garden while waiting, that's chapter 2, verse 7 to chapter 3, verse 5. And then secondly, enjoying the garden when married, 3:6 to chapter 5, verse 1. Protecting the garden and then enjoying the garden. First then, chapter 2, verse 7 to 3, 5. Protecting the garden while waiting. Now, it's pretty obvious that the section, this bit, is framed by the refrain that comes up. So chapter 2, verse 7, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. And you get the same in chapter 3, verse 5. It's somewhat of a refrain in the book. You get it in chapter 8, verse 4, a little later on. A call to put love in its right place. Gratification is a good thing. In the right place. Now, what about this oath? I don't know about you, but I don't often swear oaths on gazelles. That's just not my vibe. I don't, when I'm making a solemn vow to anyone, I don't say, oh, antelope, I lay my hands on your head and make a solemn promise that I will be at my whatever son's graduation on whatever, whatever it may be. I don't suppose many of us do. You don't often get that in the Old Testament either. What's going on? I swear by the gazelles and the does. What? I think, I don't want to have a fight with anyone about it, but I think what's going on here is she's saying, don't be driven by instincts like the animals are. Don't say, I'm just a mammal with crucially instincts to mate. You're not a beast of the field. You're a human, you're a man, you're a woman, you're made in God's image. So don't act like an animal that just gets on with it whenever it can. I think I wouldn't have a fight about it, but I think that's what's going on with this slightly curious call, this charge to live in that way. But this section, 2:7 to 3:5, it's full of longing, but appropriate waiting. Both are there. So chapter 2, verse 8, what a guy. Listen, my beloved, look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills, jumping over tall buildings in a single bound, and la, 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 la. It's Superman, here he is, and what a guy. But my beloved is like a gazelle or young stag. And yet, there's a barrier of some kind. Verse 9, he's outside. Look, there he stands behind our wall. It's a wall they've constructed. Okay. Gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. And so he woos her, apparently, through the windows. I mean, she's so impressed with what he said that she seems to have memorized it and written it down. So verse 10, my beloved spoke and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. The winter is past, the rains are over and gone, flowers appear on the earth. The season of singing has come, the cooing of doves is heard in our land. Much like April outside, winter is gone, thank goodness. And the plants are getting out, and the daffodils have almost been and gone, and everything else is budding, and the blossom is on the trees. He's saying, my darling, it's springtime, let's get it on. It's time, he says. And she likes this. It's, you know, she's memorized it. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one. You get it again. Verse 13, arise, my darling, my beautiful one. And yet, again, verse 14, she's out of reach. Tantalizingly close, but somehow inaccessible. So he says, my dove is in the clefts of the rock, in the hiding places of the mountainside. So she's behind a wall, she's behind a window, she's behind a lattice. He can see her but not touch her. She's hidden away. Oh, show me your face, let me hear your voice. Your voice is sweet, your face is lovely. Can't. It's not time yet. They can't get together yet. And also he, maybe they, it's slightly unclear, but verse 15 says, and it's a plural imperative, sorry for being slightly dull. He says, hey, you lot, hey, for some here, y'all, hey, y'all, catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom. Hey, he says, they say, to the friends always lurking in the background of the Song of Songs, can you help us? There are these foxes. What do foxes do? They come into the garden, they dig it all up, they eat the fruit. We want to keep our garden pure, and there are all these pressures and stresses, and we're struggling to keep our garden pure. Hey, you lot. Hey, friends, can you help us maintain our purity sexually? Seems to be what's going on here. And so verse 16, she says, look, my beloved is mine and I am his. He browses among the lilies. She's looking forward to that. We'll see. It's a recurrent sexual innuendo throughout the book. To browse amongst the lilies means I'm looking forward to him browsing below my waist. If you understand, that's what she's longing for. But not yet. Verse 17, not yet, until the day comes, not yet, until the day breaks and the shadows flee, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the rugged hills. Essentially, she says, look, we both want to get it on, but not yet. You're a bit overheated. Go for a run in the hills. Go and burn off some energy elsewhere. Go to the gym, exhaust yourself, go and play some sport, because not yet for you and for me. It is not yet time to awaken further our desires, she says. But it's not easy, I think is the point of chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. She doesn't find this easy because she loves him. And so here's a period of their courtship. Are they engaged in modern terms? I don't know. But there's frustration here and longing. So four times here you get the one my heart loves, or my soul would be a more consistent translation. So chapter 3, verse 1, all night long on my bed I looked for the one my heart loves, my soul loves. I looked for him, I didn't find him. I'll go into the city, I'll search for the one my heart loves. Remember, it's poetry. This is not a narrative. This is not like reading, I don't know, the Book of 1 Kings, and then the king got up and he wandered into the city. It's not that, it's a poem. This is how I feel, she says. We're almost there, but we're not quite there, and I want to be with you, but I shouldn't do in that sort of sense. And, I'm emotionally, hormonally, I'm just like we want one another, don't we? But not yet. So I go into the city, and the watchman found me. What? As they made their rounds around the city, have you seen the one my heart loves, my soul loves? Well, as soon as I passed them, I found the one my soul loves. I wouldn't let him go. Till I brought him to my mother's house, because that's what everyone wants to do when they're in love with someone. Let's go to mum's house. I think I want us to have a sexual union, but appropriately, publicly acknowledged. Let's just not have an illicit tumble in the woods. Let's do it appropriately. It's publicly acknowledged. So we can go to mum's house and have sex there when we're married. It's no problem. And we're back to the refrain in chapter 3, verse 5. Longing, desiring. Protect the garden while you're waiting, she says to us. Now, very briefly on this then, practically, what does that mean? Two little groups, I suppose. Single and dating, that's some. Just hear the wisdom of the song here. It is really hard to set proper boundaries on sexual intimacy when you are really involved emotionally with someone. It's just really hard. That's what they're saying. It is normal to find it difficult to wait to have sex with someone you love. That is not strange. You're not the only person, people, to ever experience that. So don't be daft. That's why she recalls them. Look, I urge you, in the language here, I charge you. You've got to be deliberate here. Don't be like an animal. But you have to think about it. Every so often, you'll get a couple here, a young couple, they're dating, and a little coming, oh, we're going off on holiday. Oh, really? Yeah, going off on holiday, just the two of us to Italy for a week. Oh, lovely. And where you stay? Oh, in a hotel. How many rooms? Just the one. Okay. Yeah, don't worry, we'll behave ourselves. Will you? You're going to Italy on holiday? It's out all day and wine and good food, and you're going back to one room and you're going to behave yourselves? Oh, yeah. Well, you should call it off then. Because in that scenario, if you don't go beyond your boundaries, you clearly don't like one another. Now, I'm being mischievous and naughty, of course, but I say to people, I wouldn't behave myself in that scenario 30 years ago. Really? Guys, come on. Don't be naive. There's a naivety to that. Look, these desires are powerful. God has made them so. So don't be daft. There are no rules given in the Song of Songs, but don't be daft. Ask others sometimes, can you help us? Catch the little foxes for us, with us? Keep us accountable? Single and dating. Single, not dating. Perhaps a larger group. Some obvious things here. Look, tending your sexual garden is not, it's not just refraining from intercourse. It's protecting your heart. It's protecting your mind from the habitual lusts, from the fantasies. Obviously, I was thinking about this, but just on Wednesday, same day, two articles, different papers. The first was Lena Dunham. I'd never heard of Lena Dunham. I'm a big ignorant of such things. Anyway, famous for writing and starring in the TV series Girls. Girls was apparently massive. I've never seen it. It ran for 6 seasons, made a wild splash. And she's released her autobiography, and this was just an interview with her. And it was just miserably sad. Because in her teens, into her 20s, she was honest about the desperate sense of approval she had. Longing for approval, for affection. And so she dated, slept with a vast array of wildly inappropriate men who degraded her sense of worth even further. And it's just really miserable. And that's not out there. Over the years, a small number I've chatted to here, but I take it if they talk to me, it's representative of a much larger group. A small number of young women who have reached the point of just saying, yeah, I've made a mess. So desperate for approval. I've sent out all these naked selfies. Why did I do it? And yeah, I gave up myself to silly men because I just wanted to be loved. I wanted their approval. But of course, I see it now. What a stupid place to look. The second article, very, very different. This one was just daft. So this made the news a bit because it was so silly. The Labour MP, Samantha Niblett, do you see this one on Wednesday? Labour MP wants to make adult toys, to take adult toys into Parliament for a summer of sex. And you just think, I don't know if many commented, brilliant. That's where we're at with our politicians. Some pretty big issues in the world, I reckon. And the UK needs some serious politics. And, you know, what about the economy? And what about all sorts of issues? And, yeah, stuff that. Let's just bring sex toys into Parliament, she says. And why would you give that as a public statement, an interview? What planet are you on? But then I read the article. She said, the first time I clapped my eyes on pornography, I was 10 years old. I sometimes wonder, having seen it so young, whether pornography has shaped the person that I am today. And you read that and you think, yes, sadly, that's probably true. If you think your job as a politician is to encourage others to bring sex toys into Parliament, rather than concentrate on the matters of hand, I think, yeah, you've been distorted by unreality, sadly. So just a warning again, a reminder of the recurrent dangers that pornography brings. And as many know, you think you're feasting at a table of delights, but you get up starving with ashes in your mouth and loneliness in your heart. And the song would say, don't arouse and awaken love until it's ready. You need to protect the garden for your own sake, as well as honoring the Lord. So protect the garden. But protect the garden in part because we need to enjoy the garden. And the garden is a very wonderful thing. So you need to enjoy the garden when married. It's wedding day, chapter 3, verse 6, it's wedding day. Who is this coming up from the wilderness like a column of smoke? Who is this like the Lord leading Israel in the wilderness? It's Solomon. No, it isn't. It's the one who looks like Solomon. It's my Solomon. Escorted by 60 warriors, David had his 30 mighty men. But my Solomon, my lover, the one I love, is even better than King David, I think she's saying there. And he's got a posh carriage and he's like a king and... it's amazing. She's so excited. And so she calls upon her gang, verse 10, 11. Daughters of Jerusalem, look upon King Solomon, my Solomon. Look upon my Solomon wearing a crown, the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding. The day's heart rejoiced. I'm sure there's a day of great joy. And chapter 4, verse 1, the groom gives a good speech. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats. And your teeth are like a flock of sheep. Just Sean coming up from the washing, each has its twin. Lovely. I won't bother sharing it with you, but I did find someone had drawn this picture literally, what the woman would literally have looked like in chapter 4. And basically, it's just a monster. Like, it's absolutely hideous. And you think, mate, it's good on your wedding today to say my bride is beautiful, but some of these metaphors and idioms, I think you've got it a bit wrong. Until you think, no, he's using the language of the promised land. You read something like a Deuteronomy 28 is a good place. And here is the language of health and fertility. And every sheep has its partner. And there is no barrenness and there's no infertility. Oh, that's the backdrop. Lips like a scarlet ribbon. Oh, there's only one other place that comes up in the Old Testament. Joshua chapter 2, Rahab the prostitute has a scarlet ribbon that protects her from judgment that comes upon the city of Jericho. Oh, okay. Your neck like the Tower of David. Basically, he's saying to her, you like all the best bits of the Old Testament. All the best bits. You're like King David, who no one could ever defeat in battle. You're like this extraordinary transformation that Rahab had in joining God's people. You're like a fertile garden, like the promised land, is what he's saying. And he wants to, verse 5, he wants to browse amongst the lilies. He wants to go to the hill of incense. And what is obvious now is that they're married, because the language comes up of bride. chapter 4, verse 8 to chapter 5, verse 1, the only point in the song where bride, she is a bride. And come away with me now, chapter 4, verse 8. Come away with me from Lebanon, my bride, descend from the crest of Ammonah, from the mountains, haunts of leopards, from the lions' dens. In other words, you were inaccessible. It wasn't okay for us to be together. Come now. Now we're married, we can be together sexually, I think is the point there. And all these lovely metaphors in 10 and 11, you smell good, you taste good, you look good. And so she can say now that they're together, verse 16 of chapter 4, blow on my garden, let its scent be spread everywhere. Let my beloved come into his garden, taste its choice fruits. And so he does, chapter 5, verse 1, I've come into my garden, my sister, my bride, I've come. So this language, I've scribbled it at the bottom of the page, the recurrent doesn't always come through in translation, but do not awaken love, chapter 2, verse 7, chapter 3, verse 5, chapter 8, verse 4. But now do awaken love, chapter 4, verse 16. You get it again in chapter 8, verse 5. Do awaken. She says, this is where I awoke love, or I aroused you. The point being, there's a time to protect the garden, and there is a time to enjoy the garden. God invented sex with all its intense, emotional, and physical pleasure. He created it as a way for you, if you're married, to bless your spouse and them to bless you. And we need to remember that. Some would have grown up in churches where the message was sex is bad and women are temptresses and it's all avoid, avoid, avoid. No, it's a wonderful blessing in the right place. And it seems to me, and I've adapted this from someone else I thought was helpful, it seems we have to hold in the song these three things together, all three of them, right? Sexual desire, tender affection, and legal commitment. You've got to hold all three of them together. And if any of them are missing, there's something's gone a bit wrong. So lots of our culture will have just sexual desire. That's the only one it's got. And that is hookup culture or lonely pornography. Some marriages will have the sexual desire and a legal commitment, but there's no tender affection. Arranged marriages, coercive marriages, abusive marriages, they've got 2 out of 3. Sometimes in Christian marriages, there's 2 out of 3, but tender affection is missing. And it's a horrible place to be. Some will have tender affection and legal commitment, and they're okay, but there's no sexual element to the marriage. And there's frustrations in that, and there's disappointments in that, and you've got to talk about it with one another. Some will have perhaps sexual desire and affection, but there's no legal commitment. It's just short term. It's just temporary. It's a wonderful phrase in the marriage service. The gift of marriage brings husband and wife together in the delight and tenderness of sexual union and joyful commitment to the end of their lives. In that context, got all three? It's a very wonderful thing. And you can enjoy the garden of sexual delight then. So look, you've got to protect the garden at some times. There's a season in marriage where you can enjoy the garden, the tenderness. So lastly, just very briefly, how do we garden well? Let me say two things here to push this metaphor a little further. How do we garden well? The one I've mentioned slightly already. The first is that purity is a community project. The friends are always there in the Song of Songs. I mean, almost inappropriately so, it seems in chapter 5, verse 1, they're married and he's come in, I'm coming in, and yeah, go, yeah, we're all here. We're here on your wedding day to say, enjoy yourselves. Yeah, you can leave now, friends, okay. But there's a commitment to helping one another. The friends are there. The marriage morning yesterday, Sam said a helpful thing, you know, you in your marriage, you want to be talking to God, you want to be talking to one another, and there's some friends you want to talk to about marriage as well. It was a helpful little trio, and there's that sense of it in the Song of Songs. And certainly in chapter 2, verse 15, when the man, says, can you help us? Catch for us the foxes, the things that are going to ruin our garden. Dig it up, eat the fruit, spoil it. We need help. He's saying, I think there, can you help us be pure? And in the culture of 2026, golly, we need help. So this is not just a book really for men and women and married and singles to think, how are we doing? But it's a book for a church to ask, what is the culture we're setting? What are the norms that we expect in our church about sexual behavior? How do we help one another follow the path of obeying the Lord rather than just following our own desires, instincts, like animals at points? What helps? What hinders? The church has to be a place where there are friendships, where there are friends like these friends in the book who love us, who comfort us. It has to be a place where we have friends who know us deeply, a place where we're deeply known and we know them. It has to be a place where those who struggle with loneliness, living lives of same-sex attraction, or living lives where they've been single for much longer than they would have chosen, they're known, they're loved, they're helped. Others are helping catch foxes for them. I think the point here is that you can't manage the garden alone, or even sometimes just as a couple. Purity is a community project. And last thing to say, there is a better garden. There's a better garden to come. This wedding, when it finally comes, when Solomon, her Romeo, her Adonis, when he arrives, it's a lovely picture. And so when she speaks of him and he arrives in chapter 2, verse 11, it's his wedding day. It's the day his heart rejoiced. And you read in this description of him being like King Solomon, and you can't help but think this is 2 Samuel 7. This is David's son, Solomon, who is king and who will reign forever. And it's hard to read this without jumping ahead to, I think, Revelation chapter 19, verse 7, where we look forward to the new creation, the new Eden. And we're told, let us rejoice and be glad and give him glory, for the wedding of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. Fine linen, bright and clean was given her to wear. We're looking forward to that day. Our shame is covered, our mistakes forgiven, our mistakes paid for. We need to recognize again that the desires we have in this life, they come from the same well, from the same root within us that God has hardwired for to desire him, to long for him, to find our fullness in him. And the intensity of our desires now is but a shadow of our longing to be with him. We can know him now in part, but to be with him. We need to know that. We need to know that Jesus lived on this earth perfectly, the only person who ever has, without being married, without enjoying the delight and tenderness of sexual union. Did he miss out? You can't say Jesus missed out in that sense. He lived perfectly. But he was the one who was looking for a different bride. In the language here within the song of chapter 3 and verse 11, he was looking forward to a different wedding when his heart rejoices. So now we live in the period where he says to us, chapter 2, verse 10, my darling, a day is coming, arise and come with me. That day is coming. There is a better marriage to come in a better garden. And knowing that can keep us going. It can put the desires that we have in this life in the right context, in the right place. And there's a sense in which those desires can stir up within us a longing for that day, a better wedding, in a better garden. Because even the best in this life has its pain and its frustrations and its hurts. But it's pointing to then. Let me lead us in prayer. Father, again we say, what a strange book to our minds, to our eyes, our thinking we find in the scriptures. Such a vivid and descriptive book with beautiful language expressing desires and longing and appreciation and delight. And Father, the best of human relationships, the best of marriages knows that in part for seasons, but never lasting in this world. Would our longings point us to the next? And in doing so, help us to both protect and enjoy the garden as best we're able here and now. We ask it in Jesus' name.